Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and all I want to say this week is that so long as anybody but Sheamus ends up as world champion at the next pay-per-view, I'll be celebrating like Vince McMahon at the end of Survivor Series 2001.
I'm Carl Jones, and when it comes to WWE's latest attempt at a world title tournament, I haven't seen that many zeros on a docket since the character witness list at Vince's steroid trial.
I'm G. John Chase, and I think my jump the shark moment was when I watched some China porn. After about an hour and 15 minutes, I finally realised a semi is as good as it's gonna get.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and if the SCG crew were to play the members of Happy Days, I'd obviously be the Fonz, Carl would be Al, Liam would be Richie, and Chase would be Joni.
This is the panel for the 61st Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about jump the shark moments in wrestling history next. Everyone, and welcome to the 61st Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside Carl Jones.
That's nearly the same number as my age.
G. John Chase. And Kieran O'Rourke.
Hey.
Lovely and topical there, because we are, of course, here today to talk about jump the shark moments in wrestling history. We left this one very, very vague and open to you, the loyal listeners, for your feedback on this one. Very much looking forward to this. A lot of potential wrestle crap moments to talk about here today. Jump the shark moments in wrestling history, of course, just to define this for those of you who may not know the term or may not know what we're going to talk about here today. Obviously, an allusion to Happy Days. What was the moment that made you stop watching wrestling for a period of time, stop watching the company for a period of time, made your friends stop watching for a period of time, or nice and vague moments that are just classic jump the shark moments that obviously you just want to kind of talk about here today. So a lot to talk about, record levels of feedback that we have for this one, so we're going to get to as many moments as we can throughout the course of the show. But before we do, just a little bit of a programming note for next week, because by popular demand, we are indeed returning to the Monday Night War timeline for next week's show, the fourth quarter of 1997 in the Monday Night War, complete with notes from the Wrestling Observer newsletters of the time. So much to talk about next week. I'm very much looking forward to this show. Love these timelines. If you haven't heard any of our previous ones, you can go back to the archives at squaredcirclegazette.com and catch up. Also, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/scgradio.
A little bit of housekeeping. I would like to apologise to my thousands of Twitter followers who were anticipating my in-depth play-by-play Raw coverage from Monday, and I've got to take my charges. My phone died. Sorry.
I waited by the phone for hours.
Let's get here to some jump the shark moments. It seems logical to get to the very obvious one first. So let's get to the rotting corpse in the room, if you will. Katie Vick. Niall Clark on the Facebook page says, "The Katie Vick storyline was a jump the shark moment where Triple H pretended to have sex with her corpse. Turned me off for more than a month. I came back for Survivor Series, but I skipped No Mercy that year, which was the first time I'd skipped a pay-per-view in a long time." Dominator from TPWW Forum says, "Can't believe that no one in this thread has mentioned it yet, but at the end of Raw one night in 2002, Triple H showed up and said two words, Katie Vick. Now the storyline was as atrociously bad as it could be to begin with, but then they showed supposed footage in a funeral parlour with Triple H in a cane mask and red shirt, with Big Freakin' Machine written on it, having sex with a cheerleader mannequin meant to represent Katie Vick. My poor, poor eyes and ears." And WWF Chili from the UK fan forum with a typically fantastic take here. "Kane was a monster. Burned in a fire as a child, he spent utmost of 20 years, theoretically from the mid-70s as a child, recovering from burns and spending many years in an institution. He was looked after by his biological father, Paul, and after years of recovery, Kane eventually emerged into human contact in 97, and things have never been the same." Sorry, no, wait, fuck that. "Turns out he was out and about in 1992. He was at college frat parties, actually, in his mask, I assume. Pissed as a fart, causing road traffic accidents, in his mask, I presume, and killing his close mate, Katie. Then shagging his close mate, Katie. Fucking do one, 2002. Do one right up the tradesman. The fucking state of you." They didn't just have the Kane character jump the shark. He jumped it, landed on it, then fucked it.
Could have been a masquerade party, you know.
This has to be mentioned. This is the most logical one to talk about in terms of jump the shark moments. It's actually funny because this is obviously one of the first ones that comes to mind, but I remember expecting this was going to be worse than it actually was, because I don't know if anybody remembers around this table, but I'm sure some listeners will. The Observer website reported earlier in the day that they taped a segment where Triple H dug up the corpse of Katie Vick and had sex with the corpse. Okay. And it's like, that sounds horrific. And then as it turns out, he's doing it with him. It's a mannequin and he's a spoof on Kane. It's like, it's so stupid. And yeah, I don't know if anybody wants to talk about their "I screwed her brains out" punchline, which is...
You know, the whole segment was for that one line, I think.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, oh, we've got to do something when I can say this line. Fucking atrocious.
Wasn't it the deal that Vince went around like repeating the punchline constantly and laughing at it like
really?
Throughout the day?
There you go.
You can just picture him around in the back, can't you, doing that walk of his... And,
ha ha! part of me doesn't really have that much sympathy because it was Kane. And there was a limit to what it was going to achieve anyway, but this was during the real rank period of Raw where they're looking for everything. Ratings were falling. It was shock value all the way here. And there were a few things around this time. The Billy and Chuck wedding over on SmackDown at the same time where they were reaching for everything, and it was getting pretty desperate, and it didn't scream more desperate than this.
No, I mean, obviously, things like the HLA as well during this period, it was another sort of black eye on the year, as it was. Much like yourself, I was expecting it to be far worse than it was.
And of course, just for folks in the States, it was edited over here, so we didn't actually get to see it on the Sky Sports broadcast, so we have to find this on the internet to see how truly awful it got.
I actually think that the part that I find more egregious is the actual bits before that, the last email I referenced, the fact that, you know, years worth of storyline just pissed away.
When Kane's doing the promo in the ring, right, recapping the history of what actually happened, it's like, oh.
And the heart-to-heart with Terry Runnels in the back before all this, it's just the illogical nature of it is just infuriating to me.
Do you reckon maybe that's why they've kept him around for 13 more years?
Sorry, mate.
Oh, we're sorry, Glenn.
Yeah, we really shouldn't have put you through that, really, in hindsight.
And I said jump the shark. He's just a really shit segment and stupid idea. It's like, oh, for fuck's sake, why are they doing this bollocks? Yeah.
But came the idea of Kane in his mask at a frat party, you know? It's like, what's the deal? Like, be consistent with this fucking character. He's already...
There with the voice box?
Yeah.
Just being held upside down as they got, like, a straw from a keg running into the slit in his mask. Yeah. Down, chug it. Just Undertaker waiting in the car.
Lighting joints with his magical fire powers. That's pretty sweet.
At the time, I remember it being, like, really bad. Now it's just kind of more just funny than anything, just because of the absurdity of the fact that they actually thought this was entertaining TV.
Vince probably still does.
Oh, I'm sure he does. He's a retard.
Well, the big controversy, I remember the next day at the SmackDown tapings, the story came out that enough people were mad and grumbling about how stupid this was. And then Vince did the meeting, like, if any of you writers have a problem with this, get up and leave. And no one said a word.
Yeah, as if they would. The funny thing is, I'd actually stopped watching Raw before this. I think it was probably literally the moment that Eric Bischoff just gave Triple H the world title, which put me off Raw. So I was actually pretty much a SmackDown guy for a short term. So if anything, this angle, when I heard about it, because of how absurd it sounded, it actually made me tune in to watch Raw, just to kind of see the absurdity of it. It's like, how the hell are they going to do this? How are they going to get away with this? It's just horrible, you know. It's the same with any other angle they've done, like, you know, I think of the Muhammad Hassan, you know, and the
terrorists
and all that stuff, you know. Like, again, I wasn't really watching SmackDown at that point, but like, I wanted to watch it just to see like how bad it was. It's car crash TV. It's the same as X Factor. I'm slightly different to you guys, because I was actually kind of still slightly liked Kane at this point, so I actually did feel bad for him. Also, just for the fact that, you know, again, it was just another guy that Triple H was burying in this early days of his reign of terror, and also because at the time as well, he was Intercontinental Champion as well, and, like, you know, it was all part of this long burial where Kane was going to lose in the end. We're going to lose the IC title as well. It was just
it wasn't supposed to, but they
well, yeah, it wasn't supposed to, but that's what happened in the end, and I'm sure this played its part. But came into watching it to see how much of a car crash it was. I didn't like looking at the wreckage.
No, this is one of those feuds too. It just seemed like everything about it was completely cursed. Because do you remember the when they did the segment to end Raw where Kane stuffed Triple H in the boot of the car, got in the car and drove off, and then unfortunately the boot opened to end the show, and you can just see Triple H lying there. It's like, oh, this just stinks. Like, that's just bad stuff.
They just kept the camera rolling until he came up to like a stop sign and just calmly got out the back.
Theo Diaz from TPWW says, "It was me, Austin. The whole ministry angle was really corny and all, but it was at least good storytelling. Say what you want, but it made supervillain Vince into a sympathetic figure when Taker was going after his family, forcing him to crawl to Austin for help, but it killed the angle dead in its tracks. Son of a bitch indeed."
The only thing I kind of really remember about that angle, which the whole angle with the teddy bear.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I never kind of got that. I guess maybe I saw that whole segment out of context, but it was just kind of like, Vince is crying because
Taker got to his house and stole the teddy bear.
Yeah, I put it that he burnt his teddy bear.
Vince's personal.
Because again, I saw it out of context. I thought, like, he just burnt, like, Vince's teddy bear.
You think this was?
And he's crying.
This was Mr. Burns and Bobo.
Yeah. It literally was.
Maybe it's where he stashes the steroids, Vince.
Allegedly.
Oh, well, yeah, allegedly, or cash, or coke, or.
I just remember so many people at school being like, "Oh, it's Vince." After all the build of the higher power, it's Vince again.
Yeah, it was like, ah, oh, they didn't have any better ideas, did they?
They didn't have any better ideas, and like 2 months later, they blew the whole thing off, and Vince was gone. Bit of a stretch. I wouldn't say jump the shark in terms of killing interest in Austin or anything like that, but certainly in terms of like the ministry storyline.
It was just sort of anticlimactic. Though I must admit, it's never one of those instances that's had much bearing on me, mainly because I was never a fan of Undertaker, and I didn't like the ministry angle.
No.
As a whole, so the fact that Vince was the higher power just sort of a, oh right, okay.
I think what was disappointing was it was because it was that period, and it was obviously a super exciting time. You had people jumping back and forth. They're going to bring someone in who's going to be above Undertaker. It was the anticlimax of it being Vince. We're just treading water. Wanted to throw this hook out there of who's it going to be,
and it's one of those things too where it's like if you put 2 seconds worth of thought into this, you can think of so many things like, well, if Vince was really in on it all along, then why did he help Steve Austin beat The Rock at Backlash? Like, it's, you know, stupid shit like that. Death from Above from Pro Wrestling Only says, I stopped watching WWE for a while during the Attitude Era and went full WCW when they did the angle where Terry Runnels took a bump that caused a miscarriage. It was the last straw of Russo inspired distasteful angle that I just didn't want to see any more of. The angle made me uncomfortable. It was inappropriate for wrestling in general, and the whole show at that point, no matter how high the ratings were, was terrible. I didn't watch Raw regularly after that. So of course, then WCW hired Russo. Great, just great.
We mentioned before about the Katie Vick storyline being pure shock value. The thing is, as terrible as that is, at least it's in the context of a world title match that's on the horizon. I'm not defending it, don't get me wrong, but there's some sort of tie to a wrestling element there eventually, whereas this, there is no payoff, there's no real feud between wrestlers or anything. It's just a little, it's like a sideshow, sort of freak show element to Raw, which is just, you know, offensive to anyone it's happened to. And like I say, the lack of any sort of legitimate wrestling payoff just makes it all the worse.
Sorry, I actually don't remember this angle at all. Can you put it in some context?
Yeah, so Terry Runnels claimed to be pregnant. She said it was Val Venus's, but Val said they had a vasectomy because of his line of work, so they didn't know who the dad was. And then D'Lo Brown was trying to...
Don't forget Kai and Tai, Choppy Choppy the Pee-Pee.
Well, of course, and I'm surprised no one voted for that, actually. But yeah, so then obviously she's managing D'Lo and Sexual Chocolate at the time, along with Jacqueline during the PMS phase. And D'Lo accidentally knocks her off the steps. She sells, she cries, which made it doubly offensive, because even if you aren't personally offended by the nature of the miscarriage, you can easily be offended by how poor the acting was and just and how just terrible this was on every front.
Well, it's a classless angle from a classless guy, Vince Russo. Again, though, it's kind of something. Was it their cheap way out? Again, it's kind of Russo's lack of foresight. Yeah, we'll do a pregnancy angle. Oh, fuck, but she's not pregnant, so what are we going to do?
Miscarriage.
Get the white coat hanger.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christ. Unfit Finley from the UK fan forum. I've got an obscure one. Jamie Noble and Billy Gunn versus the Bashams. I think a superstar, he says, but I think Velocity sounds about more right on this. Yeah. If I remember right, Noble beat Gunn for the right to have sex with Tori Wilson, because women are objects, obviously, which somehow progressed into Noble, Nydia, Billy, and Tori all sleeping together, which was a hideous angle on SmackDown. Although it did feature Jamie Noble in his cowboy boots, cowboy hat, and pants. So I'm watching this match on Superstar / Velocity, and it suddenly hit me that I was spending my Saturday morning watching swingers wrestle gimps, though I obviously wasn't part of WWE's target audience anymore, and I should probably do something more productive with my life. That last part didn't work, but it did stop me watching WWE for ages afterwards. That phase of the Bashing is so embarrassing to watch. When we watched watching the other day, and your missus was here, and it's like, oh god, watching the Bashing with Shaniqua coming out together, this, what the fuck, how do you explain this to somebody else that's watching, you know?
And it's on where, because there's another one on SmackDown where Heyman walks into the, goes through one of the doors, and he just finds the Bashams tied up with their mouths corked, and Shaniqua stood there with a, you know, like a riding crop, and you think, God's sake.
I'm glad
no one's walked into the room and seen me watching this.
Steve Bacenek from the Facebook page said, for the group, Katie Vick is the hands down winner, but for me, as someone who experienced the Crockett territory at its height, the final straw for WCW for me was Crazy Flair. The skits were so bad that I took the batteries out of the remote just in case I want to switch back to the train wreck. This, of course, is the phase where Flair gets institutionalized by Piper and Arn Anderson and ends up in the Nut House in his underwear And Scott Hall makes a cameo. He just happens to be there. He hadn't been seen in months, and he's just there in the Nut House with Flair. And this is Asia's debut. This was hideous.
Yeah, during that horrific period where Flair's claimed to be president of the world, Piper's claiming he wants to be president, and they get involved in a feud which eventually just ends with Piper becoming his vice president. Charles Robinson has a week in charge, which was the only bit I found entertaining at any stage. And of course, it all just culminates in Flair bailing himself out of the institution.
Which
you can do that.
You can indeed just cash in and get out. Yeah.
Makes you wonder why he stayed there for any length of time.
Yeah, the only environment where the other people are crying more than him, I suppose. I don't know. The train's completely off the tracks here in WCW.
Who was booking at this point?
Was Nash.
This is Nash.
Okay. Yeah.
It just shows how quickly the wheels came off in WCW once they started losing again, isn't it? You know, you get to the start of 99, and whilst they're making mistakes, the product's still hot. A couple of lower buy rates, and the shit just hits the fan, and it spirals completely.
It's like the most drastic, from like January to like June, it's like the most drastic death spiral you've ever seen. Moving on to another one here, and certainly a death spiral for a character that was very sudden. The Elimination Chamber in 2003, of course, came up here. Bill Thompson from Pro Wrestling Only says, when Triple H beat Goldberg back in 2003, I realised it didn't matter who was over or if storylines made sense anymore. Trips was a made man, and WCW was dirty, so he had to go over, and Goldberg had to lose. I didn't tune back in for about a year after their Elimination Chamber match, and even when I did, I realised it was more of the same, and I checked out again soon after that. Not JTab from Pro Wrestling Only says, Chamber 03, this drove off a number of my friends too. There used to be a bunch of us who would chip in to watch pay-per-views together, and that Chamber match was the final straw for them. We'd spent 2 years getting more and more frustrated as Triple H charmlessly beat a load of our then favourites, such as Jericho, Booker and Van Damme, so we were all hoping that Goldberg would put us out of our misery once and for all. Then one sledgehammer shot later ended all that hope. I'd not seen my friends so deflated since England lost to Argentina in the 98 World Cup. Some of us watched Mania 20 the next year out of habit, but the group was halved, and most of them gave up on wrestling entirely. Max Moon from Wrestling Forum says, this was the last time me and my friends all watched wrestling together. Some of us would meet up sporadically for pay-per-views after that, but that was the very last time we were all together. About half the guys never watched a wrestling show again. We had one big Triple H fan in the group, and even he was absolutely disgusted with the finish. Goldberg was sort of our last hope. Seeing him get handcuffed to the chamber and humiliated by Evolution was just too much. I didn't watch the next night's Raw. I still don't know how that storyline played out. I wasn't interested or invested from that point on. Wrestling was dead to us, and one could argue that the real jump-the-shark moment for WWE was the exact time Triple H's penis first made contact with Stephanie McMahon's vagina. Lovely. Mr. Scorpio from F4W says, the same match, the one night the WWE fans really embraced Goldberg, and he looked like the 98 Goldberg again, until Triple H decided to take a huge frosted shit on everyone. I remember howling in disgust at the finish, and grabbing the nearest thing I could and throwing it to the floor, which unfortunately was my younger brother. Having seen potential new top babyfaces RVD and Booker T take a rogering by Triple H, and now Goldberg cut down, and with Austin retired and Rock off to Hollywood, at the end of SummerSlam 2003, it dawned on me that the peak had come and gone, and now things were going to get much worse.
And we talked about it before, haven't we? When you get to the point where, you know, the match, when it's built up and a guy has to win,
yeah,
and you don't pull the trigger. But it wasn't even like that for Goldberg, was it? It was kind of, had they fucked with him before?
Oh yeah, well the Rock feud was a disaster, yeah. And then he was in the mid-card deal with Jericho while Nash and Triple H was taking the forefront,
yeah,
of TV.
But this was like one night, it was like the one redeeming moment. It's like, oh, it could be okay, so it's fine still, we just got to book this, got to know how to book him right, and then they go and fuck him.
Yeah, they absolutely fuck it.
Great heel heat, Bill, it'll work great.
Yeah, this would be perfect to build up for the one-on-one next, yeah, month. And I can see by the classic by-the-book wrestling strategy, yeah, I can see the argument. And I remember, Kieran, when this happened, that was what we said on the night, this does make sense by the book. Goldberg isn't by the book, yeah, and you've missed the point of Goldberg if you want to treat him by the book.
Especially in the context of the fact that you know you've only got him for a 12-month deal.
Yeah.
So you've got to try and, you know, milk that cash cow as best you can, and that involves having him, you know, as we know, the WCW model. Short matches where he's killing guys and looking like an absolute beast, and you're right, Kieran, there was a chance to salvage something with Goldberg, because the old gold dust wig on his head and all that sort of thing,
yeah.
As you say, the Rock feud had made him out to be a complete bumbling idiot, where he chases the Rock off, gets in the car and goes after him, and Rock just then appears from around the corner.
Well, no, actually, the car didn't start, so he chased after the Rock on foot.
So yeah, they had this one chance where the crowd was sort of with Goldberg, and there was a chance for a bit of redemption. And then Triple H in his bicycle shorts put pay to that.
Yes.
After he'd already, you know, pretty much killed off Van Damme, and Booker was always the most egregious one to me, just because of the event itself and how it unfolded. In reference to what the emailer said there, he's not sure how it played out. Spoiler, Triple H eventually got the belt back.
So they knew they only had him for a year then?
Yeah.
They knew for a fact he wasn't going to re-sign?
Well, they didn't know, but I'm sure this didn't help.
Okay. If they knew they only had him for 12 months, then I think even if he had won the belt at SummerSlam, I think that's probably still too late for him. Part of me kind of wonders whether, like, seeing that might have slightly contributed in some way to Sting deciding not to head this way for a long time when they saw what they did with Goldberg.
Yeah. Fucking hell, even WCW got this guy right.
Yeah.
At least for a while.
Yeah, Jesus, yeah. The email, I think, is the first one. That was kind of quite funny when he said, like, he stopped watching for a year and then he came back and then started watching it, saw it was shit, and then left again. Yeah. Well, yeah, because the funny thing, if that timescale was exactly right and he came into a year, then he would have come right back in time to see Randy Orton win the title and then lose it a month later to Triple H, so I don't fucking blame him at all.
I think yeah, what was probably most disappointing about this one is they hadn't treated him like WCW Goldberg. For like 15 minutes, it seemed like they were actually going to.
Yeah.
And like, if they did, it would work, so they would more. And it's like, no.
No, of course not.
We'll just give you a little bit of shine so we can take it all the way.
Interesting one here. More recent. Gok from Pro Wrestling Only says, Seth Rollins ruining the Mania main event with the Money in the Bank cash-in really torpedoed my interest in WWE. At this point, I'm not even interested enough to steal their pay-per-views. I haven't watched a pay-per-view since June when I dumped my network subscription. Usually, I would at least taunt their big shows even when I wasn't watching weekly. So, Bill Thompson from Pro Wrestling Only also says, when Seth cashed in at Mania, it ruined what was a great match and it made a guy who almost had no heat, was weak as heck, and wrestled a style I didn't care for as the face of the company. I tune back in from time to time, but when Seth would give a 20-minute rambling promo that elicited no reaction from me or the crowd, I would leave again. Then I'd come back and watch some pimped match of his, think it was either trash or mediocre at best, and I knew that Seth just wasn't the guy I want to wrestle, talk, or do anything. So very harsh take on Seth Rollins, but hey, if jump the shark moment, it's all within the person. If you don't like the guy, I can certainly understand not liking a show built around him.
I don't know if the Mania win would be a jump the shark moment. Certainly I wouldn't class it as that. I could understand his title reign, how that would goes without saying. We all know what it was.
Well, I think it's probably fair to say the majority of us here were rooting for Lesnar to win that match. You know, I wasn't completely disgusted with Rollins' win on that one. I thought it was just interesting, like, finally someone's cashed in at Mania. I absolutely agree with you, Kieran. It was the show immediately following it, and it's just like the subsequent reign, which is the a turn off moment.
It's the portrayal of a champion who isn't a champion. Yeah. I think I'm right to say most of us were probably relieved, because if Reigns wasn't turning, him winning it as a face would have been a turn-off moment, because it was just too soon for him.
Yeah.
Brock wasn't retaining because of his dates. It was more positive outlook at that point, I think, than what we feared of the green face Reign. So
it was the best solution to a bad situation, as far as I'm concerned. And could understand an emailer having this as a moment if they're going in with that mindset of it's WrestleMania, there's a certain sort of majesty to it all, you want the straight up match and the clean finish because it's the big show. I can understand that sort of that line of argument completely, but in the context of that match, as we said, Lesnar with his limited dates can only hold the belt for so long. You need to have it on TV more than it would have been, and Reigns simply wasn't ready. To use the Royal Rumble as an example, how that bled into TV in the following months, and the reaction for Reigns with the belt on him in that environment would have been, it's hard to say it would have been worse than the way Rollins has been portrayed as champion, but it still wouldn't have been good. So in that sort of that one-off moment, I personally had no problems with it at all.
Shifting gears to a different promotion here, John Carn 92 from the UK fan forum says, the aces and eights in TNA.
Oh god.
Lost steam once the reveals began, although Taz's one was brilliant, though he didn't need to bang on about it every chance he got on commentary. What did it for me was Tito Ortiz, who made the crowd go mild with the August 1 warning, and then joined them to go against Rampage Jackson in the main event Mafia in a cross-promotional attempt for their Bellator Dream Fight that ultimately got scrapped due to Ortiz injuring his neck, making it all a waste of time. Colin Bollocks from the UK fan forum chimes in and says, before Aces and Eights went on for too long, I didn't mind TNA. An angle that always comes to mind was when those masked badass bikers swarmed the Impact Zone and caved everybody's faces in. We also got Sting and pre-racist Hogan doing their best rings in Murtaugh. Daft but fun. The moment it all went wrong was when their first big anticipated reveal turned out to be Bloody Devon, and all the lads sold it like Jerry Lawler when Sable got her handprint covered boobs out. Bloody Devon, and they pretended it was worth a wank. Instantly, TNA made their newish hard biker group look like low-rent jabronis. Of course, as time went on, the reveal seemed more lame as the likes of Mike Knox and Nicole Bass's slow brother were revealed as the threat. It was about this time I gave up. It could be still going on now, for all I know.
It's amazing that that was what made him stop watching TNA, when I could think of plenty of other scenarios that that company went through which was even worse. I'm primarily thinking of, and I fucking forgot her name already.
Claire Lynch.
There you go. That, you're telling me you did? You still watched after that?
I was going to say, that's two more viewers than I realised TNA had at that point.
I just never liked the Aces and Eights stable to begin with, to be honest. Even before the reveals, it's like, look at this. This is like their big angle.
And the company had already been stable heavy up to that point with the main event Mafia, you know, and
Immortal,
Fortune.
What was it? So was Bischoff involved at this point? And yeah, it was because he likes
Sons of Anarchy,
yeah. And obviously his favourite act from the Attitude Era was DOA. So it's like
Sturgis.
Bischoff had a damn pay per view because he liked bikes, hoping some of that could rub off on his pansy ass little frame.
More on that next week.
Which ironically, that business model was the TNA business model, wasn't it?
Yes.
Free fans,
no money.
In the end, no money. Strange how the world goes around in circles.
Alex Haydash, a good friend of ours, Carl, hey, on Facebook, with his jump the shark moment, says, "What?
I hope there are times when Austin's on his ranch, and he's having a beer, and he's looking out into the sunset, wherever, and he just thinks to himself, man, that was a fucking bell end for coming up with that. I like Austin, I like a lot of his work, but the whole what thing is definitely a massive fucking skid mark on his career. Because unlike anything else, with like the woos and everything, woos are fine, that's cool. What? That has ruined almost any kind of promo.
No, it's ruined like ship promos.
Well, yeah, it just destroys any ship promos. But it's also done it for like other kind of promos where it's like, you know, people are like trying to get over. Unless the person's already over. Anyone who's trying to get over, they'll get the what chant in. And there was a brief time like a few years ago where it kind of died down a little bit. It looked like it wasn't coming back, but now it's fucking all over the place again. Where you like hearing Bray Wyatt. I know Bray Wyatt like whittles on constantly, but when you're just hearing what all the time, it's just like, just shut the fuck up.
They're probably legitimately asking what the fuck he's talking about.
It's like, do you know when it was funny? It was funny when Austin did it, when it was part of his character. Okay, so it's not funny when the audience does it.
So it wasn't a jump and shock moment, it's the legacy that offends you, not the inception of the angle, because it was funny at the start.
It was funny at the very beginning when Austin did it.
As a heel.
It stopped being funny when it's still going on over 10 years later.
You know what? I just blame their shit monotone promo. Crowd knows it's a sentence structured promo, so we'll just.
One sentence, yeah. Freeze.
Yeah.
One sentence, freeze.
Let me just be clear to sort of nip this argument in the bud. To Kieran's point, when a wrestler is talented enough, they could incorporate that into their promo. They could work around it. Steve Austin is a god who has never done anything wrong. And I will not be taking his criticism from the world's biggest Kane fan, Alex.
Last from Pro Wrestling Age.
Sorry. I will not be taking that from the world's only Kane fan.
Last from Pro Wrestling Only says, here's my favourite reason I've ever heard for someone stopping watching wrestling. A friend of mine in 5th grade saw the stereo sunset flips the Southern Boys did to beat the Freebirds at Clash 12. To him it was so fake looking and he hated it so much he stopped watching until the Monday Night Wars. There's been moments like that though where it's just like stuff that like catches you off guard, like, oh, that looks so fake.
Yeah, there's been some terrible moments like that. I mean, but the one that always stuck with me, and I think I've mentioned it on this show before, and I'm recalling why I don't like the Canadian Destroyer as a move.
Oh, yeah. Alec Norton, also on the Facebook page, says, this year has seen one massive jump the shark moment for me, and that's the TM Ziggler promo for his feud with Rusev and passionless love triangle between himself, Lana, and Summer Rae. Imitating crappy gossip rag television is the nadir for any form of entertainment, but this sucked the life out of what was already a subpar story. Whilst Rusev may now be buried thanks to Lana's engagement leak online, at least it ended this travesty of a storyline.
I agree, but I think more of a jump the shark moment for those guys, particularly and Dolph. Dolph was a babyface. He was like, why would anyone want to cheer this guy? Now, apart from the little girlies, maybe you get a kick out of this kind of thing.
Total trash.
It's the Total Divas audience, isn't it? I guess.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's just sad to see Rusev involved in such garbage.
Oh, it was painful for me to see that after after the glory of Rusev's entrance at WrestleMania on a fucking tank. That was pretty much it. That was the peak, wasn't it? It's been all downhill ever since, and now he's just another guy.
Yeah, he's a member of the European Union now, isn't he? That's what they should be called anyway.
Yeah, I agree. Rick Morris, the great Rick Morris, on the Facebook page says, "My choice for this category would be the clumsiness of the brand split, culminating in Triple H simply being handed the big gold belt on Raw by Eric Bischoff. You could immediately tell that the egocentric booking by the First Family was going to completely envelop Raw for the next few years, as it did exactly. For me to mention this general point after others already mentioned Katie Vick specifically shows how the dying embers of the boom were killed prematurely in mid to late 2002. Can't tell you how many people I know walked away somewhere around that time period."
I've not a great shock, but I've got to agree with Mr. Morris here. We talked before about the brand split and the way it was poorly handled, and well, we even had a podcast about it. You can go back and listen, folks. It's a good one. To Rick's point there, I know an awful lot of people who stopped watching after the brand split. That being said, I didn't necessarily agree with their logic for not watching anymore. I think because they'd been conditioned to seeing the quote-unquote big stars on the shows all the time. When it got to the brand split, they felt it was a real come down to have thinner roster on Raw and a thinner roster on SmackDown. And when they looked at certain people being pushed, they thought, that guy's looking good now. Like, for example, to use
Bradshaw,
but people like Edge, who were quite, I don't want to say like Edge didn't do it, but they quite quickly pushed up because of the brand split. And I think because of that, a lot of people I know didn't really see it as legitimate and just sort of felt at that point, no, we've seen the sort of the be all and end all of the Attitude Era, Mania 17, all those big shows, and now we're getting this sort of this sense of a dilution of the product, and that just turned them off.
I was switched off immediately as soon as Bischoff gave the belt to Triple H, and it was just like, well, this guy doesn't deserve it. It's absolutely ass anyway, and it just seemed like a backward step, because like, we already had Triple H a champion early in the year and it didn't quite work, whilst on SmackDown he had something interesting and new with Brock Lesnar being the champion. So I kind of like stopped watching Raw really, outside of seeing the matches on the pay-per-views, and just solely focused on SmackDown for the next 2 years.
The Triple H getting awarded the belt was bullshit.
Yeah.
I think I was probably...
Can't you come with a better way?
Yeah.
You know?
Or anyway.
Like a tournament.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Sorry, Kieran. It's just that whilst none of us were particularly keen at the time, and we've talked about it in retrospect, of Triple H being the one who gets the title, the fact that it's just awarded to him is almost like salt in the wounds. You just think, even if you don't want it to be Triple H, you never just hand over a world title. It just instantly, if there is any credibility there, which is questionable when there's two world titles anyway, if there is any credibility though, you've instantly just pissed it away by handing it to someone.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to get to. I think I was more pissed off by the creation of the two titles. Brought down Brock, his title's positioned on the same level as the guy who's just been handed the title as well.
Moving on now, Embry Fan from F4W says, "I stopped watching WCW after the whole this isn't in the script moment with Nash and Goldberg. That just crossed an absolute line where I didn't even have an interest in clicking on WCW during a commercial break from whatever I was watching to see what was happening. Started watching again in the last few months of WCW after Russo left." And Lockjaw from TPWW also says, "The only time ever wrestling has jumped the shark is in WCW with Vince Russo and all the worked shoots, especially the Hogan stuff. There have been a lot of bad, cringeworthy things, but the worked shoots and Hogan things weren't just bad, they were destroying the genre."
I will say, I always to this day get a kick out of the Schiavone on commentary talking about how professional Kevin Nash is during that period.
What are they going to do now? Nash is professional, we know that.
Yeah, the old unintentional comedy there.
Yeah.
Which is probably a hallmark of WCW in its dying last couple of years.
Yeah.
But no, that's sort of the worked shoot. It's one of those things that's always grated on me, because yes, you know, we're not Neanderthals, despite what people who don't watch wrestling may think of us as fans. You know, we can find our ass with both hands, we can manage to dress ourselves in the morning.
We don't need a drool cup when we go outside.
Exactly. But when we watch this, we want to be able, even now in my bitter, jaded ways, I want to be able to try and suspend my disbelief. You know, you want to get caught up in the moment. You want to think that what you're watching is at least an athletic contest of some sort. And when you get to the worked shoot and the old "this isn't in the format," which was a Scott Hudson verbatim.
This isn't on my sheet, Tony.
Throughout that whole period, it just if you are caught up in the moment, sort of completely pricks the bubble, as it were, because you just left deflated in the sense of, oh, right, okay, so we're back to the old quote-unquote reality now, and what we watched up to this point doesn't matter because this is the bit that's real, folks. But whilst, you know, all the while, it's over probably 90% of the audience's head and it doesn't draw a dime.
This is one, I fucking hate this.
Yeah.
It's the hallmark of a guy who doesn't understand the fucking business he's working in. Wrestling, I always like to call it, it's drama in a sporting environment. So like any drama, imagine on Coronation Street if the Kevin Webster character all of a sudden starts talking about the alleged sex assault charges he's getting in real life.
That'd be great, actually.
But it makes no fucking sense.
Of course.
And it, what's even more great, and it's like Russo and whoever encourages this stuff, it's pushing wrestling away from what it is, but it's what's great about wrestling, it's what other art forms, sports, imitate about pro wrestling. The pomp, the circumstance, the promotion of rivalries and feuds, which most blatantly you look at MMA, but you look at how football rivalries are built in papers.
Boxing.
You look at how characters are built through the media, like X Factor we mentioned earlier and stuff like that. And it's all elements from pro wrestling that makes pro wrestling what it is. And then you're slapping your own business in the face because you think you're so smart you need to deliver reality. When what you should be doing is adding reality elements, like reality TV, that's not actually real, but it's reality elements around your core product. And it's just so fucking frustrating. And it's Vince Russo, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, I was going to say, I couldn't think of anything better than Goldberg looking at Vince Russo in the face and saying, fuck you, at the end of that Steiner-Nash-Goldberg match, because that was for us. So, thank you very much, Bill. WWF Chili from the UK fan forum says, Kurt Angle, Olympic sexual predator. So Booker T and Kurt Angle are going to feud. Fine with me? No, wait, we need more. Let's have Angle stir the pot by calling Charmel a, quote, gutter slut. I go on. Anything else? Well, what if we had Kurt actually love sex? Like, really nasty sex. And he wants bestiality sex with Booker's wife. Bestiality? Why, of course, that'll turn some heads. In fact, we could have Kurt face Booker at the pay-per-view and promise to rape his opponent's wife if he wins. Hang on, is this the same Kurt Angle who just beat Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania? Your point being? Yeah, this was just absolutely atrocious in every way. That kind of perverted sex, yeah? Nothing's more surreal than seeing Kurt Angle screaming, I want to have sex with your wife. Like, really close up into the camera on that episode of SmackDown.
I wonder if Jeff Jarrett ever said that to him. We'll ask Jeff next time he's on the show.
Well, it was his world.
Was he, did he say he had jungle fever as well?
Yeah.
Oh, God, fucking that's hell. We'll make him say that he's got jungle fever.
Actually, yeah, he did deliver it like probably Vince delivered it to him in the meeting, wasn't it?
It's a Vince line.
Yeah, totally. Oh, isn't the gag, again, this is one of these, these interviews that you hear the writers do on, the phrase that Vince was actually looking for was bestial. But he kept saying bestiality in the meeting, and the writer said there's a difference, and Vince said no there isn't.
Heavy hole's a goal. Well, I wonder if did Michael Hayes have a kind of role in that?
Oh, come on. Jack and Nate from F4W says, it seems cliche to say, but the Raw walkout and the subsequent follow-up episode had so many plot holes, inconsistencies and head-scratching decisions that by the end you were wondering how the show could possibly get any worse. I still don't think it ever has. This, of course, is the great R-Truth and Miz are so dangerous that everybody's walking off the job, including Jim Ross and all the cameramen and all that stuff, and Triple H is left alone in the ring while the crowd applauds, and a really strange time. The Summer of Punk had kind of morphed into the Summer of Triple H as the boss.
But the JR scene was so sad.
When he's the last one at the table.
He's the last one there, and the crowd are imploring him not to leave, and he does, and it just, your heart sinks a little bit.
What were they even leaving for?
It's the fucking Miz and R-Truth.
Yeah. JR could take them. We know he could.
Maybe they were just insulted with the push, or whatever it was.
These guys are facing Rock and Cena. I'm out of here.
You know, the fact that this is all built around the Miz and R-Truth is offensive enough. And the fact that the entire roster are made out to be such idiots that they go along with it is terrible. But then it's the fact that they follow it up with, I've got Triple H in the ring, I've got CM Punk with me. We're going to be buddies despite what we've been saying for the last 2 months.
Hey, can I borrow your blazer?
Can I wear? You can wear my blazer. Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
God, yeah.
So it just sort of, you know, just to hammer home the stupidity of it all, let's have buddies Triple H and CM Punk again.
Harmonic Generator from the UK fan forum says, I've never been the type to stop paying attention completely, but I think the biggest eye roll came when Vince's limo blew up. I mean, that's awful right from the start, because nobody's suspending their disbelief far enough to think that he's just been killed on screen. Additionally, the thing is so far-fetched that it just doesn't work set against any other element of the show. Then you get them doing fake tributes and investigations and things like that, which is in poor taste for a start, and so far removed from what people watch a wrestling show for, it's unbelievable. Then Sensational Sherry actually dies, and they try to respectfully pay tribute to a deceased Hall of Famer while keeping this piece of shit dead Vince story going. That did not sit well. The fact that it took a double murder-suicide to put an end to the storyline, we'll never know how it might have ended, but if it hadn't jumped the shark before, it certainly would have by the finish.
Do you think it would have made the angle worse or better if the people investigating Vince's apparent death was Leslie Nielsen again from like some Slam 94?
No, I don't.
Who you don't think it would have saved it?
Who no. Unfortunately himself was dead at this point.
Oh, well, there you go.
And this is not a Tony Lister one, this isn't Zeus, I'm right this time. Yeah. He really was dead.
Yeah. Are you sure?
Check it anyway.
I'm going to check it.
I'm going to go with Columbo.
He may have been dead as well.
I think he's definitely dead.
He's still alive, isn't he?
No, I'm not sure on him.
Quincy definitely is.
I don't like Quincy.
Leslie Nielsen is in fact dead, but was not dead by the time they did the angle.
Was he not?
No, he was alive and well.
So they could have brought him back. Yeah. You could have brought Dick Van Dyke in, you know, diagnosis murder. off to the races we go.
Yeah. He's one of the wheelchairs, Ironside.
That's Ironside.
Yeah, Miss Marple, not Miss Marple. Poirot. Murder, She Wrote.
We've lost everyone now.
We've jumped the show. Yeah.
We also know that Paul London probably isn't a particular fan of that story.
Oh, yeah! He's just smiling like an arsehole backstage. Yeah. And they like de-pushed him for months because of it.
You'll correct me if I'm wrong here, Liam, but wasn't this effectively just their way to get out of the McMahon $1 million giveaways they were doing on Raw every week?
No, that was the time when they were doing the $1 million giveaways and then the stage fell on him. And we never got an answer as to what happened. Yeah.
We never knew who was behind that, just like we never got an answer to who was raising the briefcase at King of the Ring 99.
Who blew up the limo. Yeah, it was all ridiculous.
WWE Unsolved Mysteries. Get it on the network.
That's great. Ambulance Chaser from the UK fan forum says, I stopped watching TNA in 2011. I think at some point after seeing the 95th RVD or Mr. Anderson match, I literally couldn't take any more and had to drop some programming because I was struggling to fit everything in during the week. I sacrificed TNA as I just had enough.
I thought he was going to say I stopped watching 2011 because I found my remote.
Yeah, the RVD Anderson match. I'm not sure if it's. Well, I think it was 2011. It's the match on pay-per-view that was so bad that half the crowd shouting restart the match and the other half shouting no.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Air Raid from the UK fan film says, for me, I stopped paying as close attention to TNA after lockdown 2009. The company had once seemed progressive, and at that show took a gigantic leap into the past with Sting losing the world title to fat part-timer Mick Foley. you should see Carl's face. And the tag belts going onto the Dudley Boys, who were also fat and knackered at the time. I had just about forgiven them for Joe losing the belt to Sting, but to go all the way back to becoming a 2000 WWF tribute fed was just too much for me. You can make the argument for Team 3D still having something to offer if you want, but for a company that was trying to make a go of being a serious number two, to put their big belt on Mick Foley in 2009 was laughable. The only time I've been more dismayed with TNA was a year later, during the Hogan Bischoff run, when they thought it'd be a good idea to put the Dudleys, 10 years past their prime, in the ring with the Nasty Boys, 20 years past their prime on pay-per-view. The fucking Nasty Boys on pay-per-view in 2010. The fuck? Come on, Carl. This seems like a ready-made one for you. Mick Foley, world champion, has jumped the shark.
I will take fat, over-the-hill Mick Foley over criminally overrated, god-bothering, balding Sting any day of the week. Joking aside, to put the world title on Mick Foley at that time is a horrific decision. One of a multitude of horrific decisions that company has made. But I would say, bearing in mind the year in question, is Sting as world champion much better, really?
Well, at least there was some kind of narrative reason, because they're doing the whole main event mafia thing, you know? It's like, if the whole idea is Sting as the leader of this group is going to lead all the veterans and monopolise the spots, it's ready made for, you know, a new guy to win.
It is. If we're going along the idea that the company actually was progressive, I would argue that the company wasn't progressive at that point and hadn't been progressive for several years prior to that. And I would just ask everyone around the table, because TNA has been mentioned a few times now, when did people around this table give up on TNA?
I gave up on TNA during the very rushed Angle Joe feud and wanted to be on board with TNA. LAX was hot, Joe was hot, AJ was great with Daniels as a tag team. Angle's in, how can this not be great? And then in 2 months you got Kurt Angle walking around backstage in a fucking G-string or whatever it was, because Samoa Joe stole his clothes.
A strange affinity for me, because I used to, you know, when I used to go see him quite a lot over in Orlando. So I always had a soft spot. The Russo thing, that was kind of a tipping point where I now know that you have no fucking idea how to run a wrestling company. And since then, it's been like instance after instance when it's just bang your head against the wall moments. And
like when Russo, like they did the spoof, like the VKM stuff, when they're challenging DX, and then Christy Hemme comes down and starts talking about how no one remembers China. And it's like, what is this? I mean, my username on F4W, for everyone who's listening, is I Hate Russo because of a specific period.
Yeah. Been to a couple of shows in Manchester and stuff, watching them. But it's like, I just have no inclination to go out of my way to watch the programming now.
But the thing that absolutely killed it for me was Claire Lynch. It was absolutely, that was the final time I watched it. They had this big angle, which was centred around someone who wasn't wrestling. And on top of that, was hired the one of the worst actresses to portray this character. And that for me is like, you're making me watch this awful actress and it's got nothing to do with wrestling. And for that, it was just like, no, now I'm done.
Just on that note, gee, boy better know from F4W said, I stopped watching TNA in 2010 when the Hulkamania party arrived. I couldn't stand it. I came back in 2012 for a few weeks until the Claire Lynch thing happened. I switched it off then and I haven't put it back on since. Maluko from TPWW Forums to move on says, I will go with Warrior Hogan in WCW and the infamous appearing in the mirror. Mm. Not only was it sad and weird, but the fact that Hogan fans and commentators could see Warrior, but Bischoff couldn't, was baffling and showed where their writing was going at the time. Yeah, the whole period of the One Warrior Nation was not one of the finer moments in WCW history.
Would you include like all the Supernatural Undertaker stuff in this?
Yeah, I would. And yeah, and you know, Wyatt on Raw like last week talking about how he summoned the Undertaker's powers, and then the
fake lightning.
Fake lightning, which on Raw looked like shit, by the way.
Yeah, I was wondering if they were going to
set the cameraman on fire.
Oh yeah, when Kane set the cameraman on fire. Yeah,
it's almost a case of what can you say about that that wasn't already covered in the death of WCW?
Yeah,
when you throw in War Games as well, where he injures himself to break the cage, and of course we all know how it ends in that just absolutely atrocious
Halloween
match
Halloween.
At Halloween Havoc, where all I'll say is botched fire paper and a log roll.
I do love in the Observer report of that match, you see when Hogan pulls out a little bag from his tights, he said it appeared that Hogan pulled out a bag full of drug paraphernalia. The promo Warrior does when he first gets there, and there's like a full minute where he just forgets what he's going to say, and then after like the commentator's like, what's going on here, and Warrior just says, patience is a virtue. On the microphone. When I get to a couple of ECW ones here, JN Lister from the UK Fan Forum says, ECW Living Dangerously 98's main event for me. There was always going to be a bit of a come down after Barely Legal, because ECW getting on pay-per-view was the promotional equivalent of a wrestler winning a first world title and no longer having the climb or chase to the top. Hardcore Heaven 97 had the shit production and November to remember the infamous Sabu Sandman debacle, but there was still potential. Then you have this pay-per-view with a main event of Chris Candido and Shane Douglas versus Lance Storm and Al Snow, which on paper should/could have been a 30-minute high-flying technical work rate classic that put the other promotions to shame. Instead, it went about 4 minutes in a ring full of styrofoam heads, with one corner blocked off with police tape because Bigelow and Taz had left a massive hole, and half of the match was shot with spinning cameras. In hindsight, it was the real first sign of the combined effects of the roster being crippled and Heyman losing his creative touch. Pretty interesting there, because I think he touches on what I feel, which is that after Barely Legal, there really was no great ECW showing on pay-per-view until Heatwave 98. I think in terms of like losing the creative touch, we see that with this next nomination here as well. Vitor from Wrestling Forum says, Aldo Montoya ECW champion. Combined with RVD getting injured/leaving, killed most of my interest in ECW. I don't think I ever went off them completely, but my interest plummeted. I was never more excited about ECW in real time than when I was regularly driving 90 miles to shows in 99 and 2000, and they got the TNN deal. By the summer of 2000, I no longer cared. And Project Humanoid from F4W says, first off, I wasn't ever a credible fan outside of the Impact players as a tag team, as I thought his dynamic with Lance was great, and Lance in ECW was great overall. But I never, ever, ever bought him as a main event guy. I could deal with Awesome and Tanaka as outsiders coming in and feuding over the title, but ECW died for me when Aldo Montoya became their champion. They also ruined what was potentially the last great ECW angle when Tommy Dreamer won the belt after dedicating the match to his grandfather who had supported his dream, only to have Credible take it from him. Obviously it was done for heel heat, but I think bookers in general don't do enough to let triumphant babyfaces breathe a little bit.
I suppose if it makes the first emailer feel any better, by the summer of 2000, Paul Heyman had pretty much given up on ECW as well.
It just shocked him too.
And maybe there's something in that Tommy Dreamer title run. What do you think, Kieran?
I don't give a fuck. about Tommy Dreamer losing anything apart from weight or a job.
Just on like a sub thing in terms of like just ridiculous. This wasn't jumping shark moment, but just in terms of Tommy Dreamer, because I've been watching the 2002 Raws. I completely forgot the side storyline that they had of Tommy Dreamer where he's like eating weird stuff.
The day in the life of Tommy Dreamer.
Like Jackass stuff where he's like, he's at the hairdresser and he's eating the shampoo.
The barberside.
Yeah, and he's like eating like the hair off the floor and stuff. And I was just like, I don't remember fucking this ever being on there. Jesus Christ.
He would later go on to eat his own vomit on an episode of Raw.
Awesome.
Wow. Maybe eat mine because I threw every time I saw him wrestle.
You knew it was a clear sign of their struggles where they've reached a point where they're having to put the belt on Credible because Awesome's left. They're having to feature him more prominently again because Lance has gone as well. And I'm not saying that Lance would have saved the company or anything, but it epitomises or sort of emphasises the revolving door of talent now leaving on a regular basis, you know, as a byproduct. They're having to focus so much attention on Credible. And it would only get worse with Van Damme breaking his ankle.
Yeah, I'd probably say, yeah, just incredible. I wasn't fond of as being champion, but I thought what was even more confusing was when Jerry Lynn won it. And don't get me wrong, I like Jerry Lynn. I think he's a good wrestler and all, but he's a bit of a, you know, a charisma vacuum. Just incredible is one thing, but when they went down to Jerry Lynn, it was like, all right, now you're kind of pushing it.
Yeah, it's almost the equivalent of arguing over semantics. I mean, I could sit here, G, and say, I would argue Jerry Lynn is a step up from Just Incredible, because whilst Jerry Lynn is a bit of a charisma vacuum, I would argue the same for Just Incredible, and the difference is Jerry Lynn can go in the ring, and I've never felt Just Incredible could. But the wider point still stands. It's the mid-card guys who were never really the focal point of the company instantly becoming the focal point. They're just sort of thrust in there because they have to, because there's no alternative.
Play like devil's advocate a little bit. Say that ECW didn't die in 2001. What would you thought would have been the best direction for him as a world champion then, if it wasn't
Rob
Just
Van
Incredible?
Damme, if you can get him.
Yeah, Rob Van Damme was a few. As I said, with the guy with Tommy Dreamer, while some people might not like Tommy Dreamer, at least he was a viable option, because outside of that, as I said with Carino, at least Carino could talk. The only other person, I guess, was Sandman, maybe?
Rhino,
Tajiri would have been a great one, but they bunged Tajiri with Mikey Whipwreck. That's no offence to Whipwreck, but like, they bunged him in a freaking tag division,
mid card tag team. Tajiri is capable of more.
He absolutely is. To me, Rhino is the way you go, in which they effectively were leaning that way right at the end. But you know, by then it was too late.
Didn't mean a hill of beans.
Absolutely not. And be great if you could get Van Damme, but we know Van Damme's not coming back because Paul Heyman owes him X amount of dollars.
$150,000.
The way to go for me would have been Rhino with Cyrus as the mouthpiece.
You see, Rhino was the only guy who was, as you say, presented like a main eventer. The rest, it was the de facto mid card had become the upper echelon. And so Rhino was the only one out of that circle who was left who was bigger. There is value in the older guys to maybe put over Rhino for him to kill Tommy Dreamer.
Sandman and Dreamer. Yeah, what they did with Sandman earlier in the year.
Yeah, so I mean, there's value there, you know, to use them to make a star, but Rhino was the only one they had approaching that. Yeah.
Another one here, just on the subject of the belt, Jap Jesus from F4W says, when Taz is ECW champ, job to Triple H on SmackDown, that was it for ECW for me. That whole thing was absolutely awful. Again, Tommy Dreamer makes a cameo and takes a pedigree. Thanks for coming, Tommy. EC Dub. Bill Diarrhea from the UK Fan Forum says, I stopped really paying any attention to WCW when the filthy animals buried Flair in the desert. This was at the beginning of the Russo run, the first run, where Russo wanted Flair off TV for a little while, and they had the filthy animals bury him, quite literally,
Jesus,
in the desert, and something else that never got paid off.
Well, it wasn't even an original idea. He probably stole it from earlier in the year when the Wolfpack had done it to Flair, and he came back with that pickaxe.
Oh, he came back in the turnip truck?
That's the one.
That was awful stuff.
So not only is it a terrible idea, it's a repeat of a previously terrible idea. Vince Russo, everybody.
He really came to the game with a lot of ideas. Get to another
one.
None
of them good.
Another one here that's obviously commonly mentioned, the Finger Poke of Doom. RWD5035 from FOW says, personally speaking, I think the Finger Poke of Doom is the jump the shark moment of WCW. I think making Goldberg a star by beating Hogan on Nitro to just have him lose to Nash via a taser, and for Nash to lose in the manner he did to Hogan, just basically was like, why even bother watching anymore? It's the same shit over and over again. No one could be a bigger star than Hogan, and reforming a dead entity like the NWO with Hogan, Hall, and Nash again was just the ultimate moment that that WCW didn't get it, or maybe they did and just didn't care. I think this is the defining Jump the Shark moment. They got a 5.0 on that Nitro and managed similar ratings immediately after, with the only show in the remainder of WCW's history topping that was when Raw was off for a week in early February. However, soon after Raw's 1 week hiatus, WCW dropped off significantly from where Raw was and never got close again. Mr. Poifect from WrestlingForum.com: for me personally, it was the WCW stuff with the finger poke of doom and pretty much everything Kevin Nash. It was like his little bully playground and I couldn't stand watching it. And there, Big Vic from TPWW Forum says the finger poke of doom was the exact minute WCW jumped the shark.
Really, from that kind of aspect, if we're going with that show, if I remember the timeline right, to say like jumping the shark, wouldn't technically the jump the shark moment for WCW would have been the Mankind announcement? Because that's what literally made people change the channel.
No, I think this was far more damaging than the Mankind thing. That's a 1 week thing. It's not like that happened. I think that's overplayed by WWE, to be honest. I mean, for their own benefit.
Yeah, you lose the night, G, don't get me wrong. It's not the sort of thing that you can't recover from. If you have put on a compelling TV show opposite that, that doesn't leave a sour taste in the mouth of those that are still watching your product, you've lost that week. You've lost several weeks prior to that. It's not the sort of thing that's going to damage the company long term. Whereas things like the finger poke of doom, and it has to be said, I find it almost hard to call it the jump the shark moment, because to me there had been so many bad things before it.
And there were more to come.
Reference the Warrior stuff that we talked about earlier, and there was horrific stuff still to come, and the company still did decent business in the immediate aftermath. I think the Flair Hogan buy rates for the following two pay-per-views did good numbers. It's just that that moment has come to symbolise all the other horrible shit that they did as well.
In front of all those people at the Georgia Dome, Goldberg takes it up the arse.
That's it. I think it's the two conjunctions, really. It's the Goldberg loss in the manor, and the finger poke of doom in that manor, and all that in juxtaposition, and just, it's a real souring of the overall feel of the product. Short, sharp blast of shit in the face.
And if follow-up to you is just
that's
shocking.
The thing. If it was just the finger poke of doom as an isolated incident. I mean, let's face it. The reason it's called the finger poke of doom is because of everything that was swirling around at the time as well. I'm not defending it in any way. It is terrible. It's the accumulative effect of all the horrible shit they've done, and the finger poke just happens to be the emphasis for it.
Because at that time, Nitro on TNT was immediately followed by Thunder over here, and obviously Nitro was head-to-head with Raw, so of course I watched Raw that night, and would watch Thunder afterwards, and not knowing what happened on Nitro, tuning into Thunder, and seeing at the start of that show what I believe was like three limousines pulling up to the building, and out filed all these NWO members with Hogan in a Wolfpack shirt holding the belt. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, yeah, it felt like watching a rerun. And then obviously, as they explain what actually happened, no, it was here and now, unfortunately. Bobby Dazzler from the UK Fan Forum says the NWO jumped for me the moment Virgil joined. Cool as fuck with Hogan, Nash and Hall doing their stuff. Still tolerable with DiBiase, the Giant and Six, but fuck me when Vincent joined, that opened the floodgates for all kinds of shit. A lot of good stuff happened after that with the NWO, don't get me wrong, but it was never as cool once old Virgil got involved, and for me the shark had jumped. It's like on Different Strokes when they brought in the Ginger Kid, and we still watched just for a few good Arnold moments. The Ginger Kid is Virgil, Arnold is Hogan. very quickly, I want to stretch around the table. Which member of the NWO joining was where it felt like a stretch too far?
It's hard to... Sorry, go on.
Sorry, I was going to say Stevie Ray.
What are you talking about, Fruit Booty? It's hard to pinpoint one because it was like a moment where you'd watch TV, you'd see what you'd call the elite members in the ring, then you blinked, and Jesus Christ, there was an army there. But for some reason, I can't get this one name out of my mind, so I'm just going to blame him and say VK Wall Street.
That's a good shame. That's not a bad one, actually. Yeah. I never understood why Scott Norton had to be in the NWO.
I was thinking Scott Norton as well, but I also thought of the analogy, it's like a mole grown on your arm. And like, you don't really notice it to start with, but before too long you realise it's a bit big now and you're probably in trouble.
You probably should go to the doctor.
So
it was Henning for me, because it was just that thing of like, everyone else, whilst it was annoying, you could see why they did it, because it was just like they were trying to like try and give some rub to some other people that otherwise just were fucking useless. Kurt Hennig, for me, there was no upside on that. I don't see what they were trying to do on that. They blatantly had something that worked better by having Hennig stay with the Four Horsemen, and so that was a real kind of bitter pill when kind of like watching that and just thinking like that was unnecessary.
I think Virgil's a good shout there.
Virgil is good. He was the first turd in the toilet before it was flushed.
The Duke from Pro Wrestling Only says, I stopped watching completely for 11 years when the invasion angle ended with WCW losing and completely being written out of storylines. Although them merging with WCW to become the Alliance, I'd already thought was pretty stupid. I did kind of follow it up at Mania to see the NWO with Hogan turning back red and yellow. That was where I completely stopped, as I knew it wasn't getting any better. So, yeah, the invasion certainly turned off many, many people. We've done an entire show on why the invasion was a piece of shit, so you can go back and listen to that in the archives at squaredcirclegazette.com for the finer breakdown. But a lot of people did mention this.
Yeah. The numbers speak for themselves in that regard. 770,000 North American buys for invasion. By the time you get to Survivor Series, it's half that.
Tiger Rick from the UK Fan Forum says, I thought the invasion itself jumped the shark the moment Stephanie McMahon walked out as owner of ECW. Yeah. I went from being ultra pumped to utterly deflated in about 5 seconds. The invasion had some decent moments afterwards, don't get me wrong, but it was just a question of how long from that point. I think an alliance headed by Shane and Paulie with a focus on the guys fighting rather than the shitty McMahon soap opera retread would have had more longevity, and there'd have been an opportunity to get guys over enough not to have to rely on WWF defectors. It had no chance once you got involved. And Andrew PCW from FOW also said, a couple of moments that almost made me stop were Stephanie buying ECW and, well, that's the big one.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fair to say just the whole invasion angle was jumping the shark. I mean, we could pick so many different things if you dissect the invasion angle of things that were, you know, moments that put you out of it. I mean, remembering like the promo Steph does where she goes like, oh, you know, me and Shane can't wait for you to die. And all that stuff.
I got one worse than that. Yeah. After Stephanie joins, I think it was on SmackDown, the one right after where Heyman introduces her, and Steph just says, Paul, from now on, you can just call me boss. And it's like, what is that supposed to accomplish?
I'd say Austin turning heel.
John Wayne from the FOW board says, I stopped watching when Stone Cold turned on the WWF. When it became obvious what a watered down angle it was, I was out on wrestling. I missed the entire back half of 2001 and all of 2002. I actually went back and watched a lot of what I missed, but the steep decline of the product justified to me why I'd stopped watching. Prior to that sabbatical, I'd been a weekly WWF/WCW watcher since at least 1994. Now, I wish WWE was as good as what I thought sucked back in 2001 or 2002.
I blame Buff Bagwell.
What's so annoying about the second Austin turn is, like, the first one didn't work for business. So they rehab it, and they got away with it to a degree. But then they just went and did it again.
It's like Russo with that Ric Flair burying him in the desert kind of thing. It's just rehashing the same angle again.
Maybe if we did it again, it'll work now. What's that line about doing the same thing and expecting different results?
Definition of insanity.
Imagine that.
Repeating the same thing again, expecting different results.
Yeah. There you go. B. Papa from FOW to move along says, Rikishi being revealed as the one who did it. I've loved WWE since, of course, but around this time I think the fad died. I don't even think the revelation was bad. The ensuing feud was a bit weak, but it just is a good thing to pick as a scapegoat for that entire time period. And DMJ from Pro Wrestling Only says, stop watching wrestling entirely for a good 4 or 5 years at the end of 2000. I actually think the moment that made me say, fuck this shit, I'm gonna go and start see punk bands and try and meet chicks, was that I did it for the Rock angle. I was a big Austin fan when he came back only to feud with Rikishi, who I never saw as anything more than a mid-card comedy character. I knew there wasn't anything cool or outsider about being a wrestling fan.
I will say, at the taping on Monday, just to find the face of that, you know, you can't get chicks as a wrestling fan, I saw in the bar afterwards a male fan seduce a female fan by proudly displaying his replica belt.
Oh, you've got to be kidding
like
me.
Like he was some kind of peacock pluming his flashing his ass feathers or something. Yeah, it was quite the sight to behold, and I was totally befuddled.
Did it work?
Yeah, it worked.
That is,
that's what I was befuddling about it.
But what was the quality of the man and the woman?
She was better than him. She wasn't bad. I probably would have.
And just for the listeners out there, which belt is it that picks up the chicks?
It was. Well, this is the thing you say. He flashed. He got her attention flashing the current title.
Ooh.
Oh.
But he won her heart with a big gold belt. Maybe it was the channeling of flare magic. That's what.
Of course it was. Yeah. Now it all makes perfect sense. Another good one here from John from the FOW message board. It says, the world of little people under the ring, or when Hornswoggle drew a hole on the wall and ran through it away from Charvo. You remember that fucking horrible angle?
Yep.
Yeah, the Hornswoggle character lends itself to plenty of shit. How about the one when he blew up the ring with Coach under it?
I was at that Raw.
Were you really?
I was at that Raw in Birmingham. Oh,
I didn't know it was in this country.
Oh, of course it was. It's the sort of shit they feed a UK audience when they come over here.
My idea would be is that we tie Hardcore Holly and Tommy Dreamer together and throw them in the river, and the anchor would be Hornswoggle. Because this guy is just an absolute abomination. I mean, you talk about, what about the freaking, he's revealed to be Vincent Mann's love child, or even the fact he became Cruiserweight champion, which I know the belt meant shit by that point, but I mean, Jesus Christ, come on. Just anything this guy has done.
Everything he's touched.
Everything he's touched. He's technically joined DX as the mascot.
And it's just awful.
Little People's Court.
Little People's Court. Shawn Michaels getting dragged under the ring. I can feel their tiny hands.
WLC.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Oh, the thing,
Oh, it's awful.
The thing is, Hornswoggle as well, there's no way he can make the cruiserweight limit, the fat little fat. He's like his mini Tommy Dreamer, for fuck's sake.
All the weight in his ass.
Yeah.
Paul Sebert from FOW says, I can't think of a pay-per-view more frustrating than Super Brawl 9, which I recall caused some friends of mine to leave WCW fandom permanently. First off, the payoff to the WCW Tag Team Title Tournament, one of the most overly long, illogically booked tournaments ever on television. Fans were eager to see Benoit Malenko go to the finals, and Benoit win his first ever WCW belt, but no, instead it goes to an unmotivated Kurt Hennig and a long past his prime Barry Windham, who haven't even started their entertaining West Texas Rednecks act yet. Then came Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, who'd never even lost the tag belts, defeating Rey Mysterio and Conan, resulting in Mysterio unmasking in an angle no one wanted to see and did nothing to get anyone over. Upon unmasking, Bobby Heenan would explain, "It's the Beaver," as Rey appeared to be 12 years old. Scott Hall defeated Roddy Piper to win the US title in an absolutely dire match, in which Piper appeared to be in no condition to wrestle, yet it still took outside interference from Disco Inferno and Kevin Nash to beat him. Bill Goldberg beat Bam Bam Bigelow. Goldberg, who was doing sellout crowds and was the face of the company, had gone from headlining shows to feuding with a guy who put over Lawrence Taylor. And finally, in the main event, we saw Ric Flair versus Hulk Hogan. After the Horsemen reunited, and after 3 years of NWO shenanigans, Flair finally was going to get his hands on Hogan. The payoff to this was David Flair turning heel and joining the NWO. An utter screw you moment to the fans, which would only be worse in hindsight, considering that 1 month later, WCW would do the Hogan-Flair double turn, where we were supposed to feel sorry for Hogan. Fuck this company. To put how damaging this pay-per-view was in numbers, Super Bowl 8 did a monstrous buy rate of 1.15. The next month's Uncensored show did a 0.77, and the numbers would continue to slip on a monthly basis until 1 year later at Super Bowl 10, the buy rate was a 0.15. In terms of when you actually look at the numbers, the Flair Hogan double turn, to me, is like the real anchor, where you see the pay-per-view numbers especially just fall off a cliff. And that, I'm surprised that nobody actually wrote in and said that double turn. I guess it's alluded to here in that one, but a very good candidate there. And then just the idea of Flair as a heel at that point and Hogan as the babyface, Jesus Christ, so far off the mark.
You said before that, I mean, Flair's going to take the stick for this as well, because
he wanted to do it.
So.
Yeah. Flair always wants to play heel because it's, you know, it's him going back to what he knows best, what got him popular. It got to a point, once you got to roughly around like the mid-90s, Flair, it was almost, for me, it was impossible for Flair to be a heel again, because it was just like, it's that whole respect thing, like he was just too well loved. And the same like with if anyone wants to try and counteract with Evolution, it's just, no, it was the same there. He got cheered, you know, everyone else got booed, but like he got cheered. It's just like Flair as a heel was just never gonna work.
Couple of interesting ones here. Slingshot Suplex from Pro Wrestling Only says, the twin referees angle on the main event was the last straw with me in the WWF for several years. I was already an NWA loyalist, but was still pretty enthusiastic about the WWF through at least Mania 3. Here was the most watched pro wrestling match in US history, and it ends in what I found to be the silliest, most intelligent, insulting thing I'd seen in years, with Hogan's insinuation that DiBiase paid for the plastic surgery, when I'd seen both Earl and Dave on TV for years. I was surprised too, in recent years, to discover that Meltzer loved the angle and thought it was a creative way to get the belt off Hogan, so there you go. Earl was the guy who got it coming over from the NWA, where he'd been a referee, to get the plastic surgery to look like Dave, the WWF referee, and give the match to Andre.
Yeah, I suppose it was a bit of a stretch, especially considering one was noticeably fatter than the other. I've never really had much of a problem with it though.
Yeah, and many, I'm actually very surprised this one came up.
I think I'm more in the Meltzer category here. I don't think it's like anything out of this world, fantastic or anything. But by the same token, I don't find it offensive. And I think if you're an NWA loyalist at that point, probably skews your viewpoint a little bit. In fairness to the emailer.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it absolutely skews it. And it's like the reason I wanted to mention that in connection with this next one from Grapple and Apple, also at Pro Wrestling Only. For me, it was 1989 WWF and the Zeus Hogan feud. It's the point where I stopped watching wrestling because that angle was so corny. I've always generally hated celebrities' involvement in wrestling, and this is one of the most egregious examples of bad celebrity usage. I also think I was disheartened because many of my Crockett heroes' transformation in the WWF. I couldn't believe what Dusty, Arn and Tully, Ronnie Garvin, and the Sheepherders were turned into in the WWF. I didn't get back into it until midnight 95 with the advent of Nitro and have been a hardcore since. But it's that thing, like you said, when you're an NWA loyalist and that's the kind of wrestling you like, the silliness that was prevalent in the 80s, you can only take so much because WWF would constantly push it. And I think they pushed it and pushed it and drove away bits of segments of fans, and then they completely fell off a cliff with Papa Shango.
But I will say, in reference to the sort of the second emailer there, I can probably understand that a bit more, even though I wouldn't. Whilst I'll acknowledge that, yes, it's going to skew your viewpoint, I could possibly see someone else being switched off entirely by the use of Zeus as part of your main event picture. I could, because that's so painful on the eyes to watch. It's, you know, it brings tears to my eyes. That sort of thing, and because Zeus was so clearly sort of a fish out of water with the when he's on offense as well, I can see why that would drive someone away, and things maybe such as, maybe not things like the Sheepherders and maybe Dusty, for example, because that's, again, that just ties into the element of, you know, see Honky Tonk Man for the outlandish character or X, Y, and Z. If but yeah, Zeus in particular is something I could see why that would drive fans away, because that's just awful to watch.
No, I could totally see why Dusty would turn people off. If,
oh yeah, oh, no, the guy that they've watched for years.
Yeah, I'm not disputing that, but in the sense of in the abstract way, if this makes sense, sort of if you're an NWA loyalist at heart,
and then you see Zeus on the other side,
and you're going to see Zeus, but if you're going to see Dusty and Polka Dots, well, if you're an NWA loyalist, you're probably not that keen, really, for the most part, on WWF's product anyway. And if Dusty isn't going to drive you away, then, as I say, someone like the Honky Tonk Man's going to drive you away. But if you're just
or
Akeem's is going to drive you away. But if you're just a natural wrestling fan, and then you see Zeus, I think that could drive you away.
Joe4372 from F4W says, I grew up in Atlanta and was all WCW. Went to college in 1998 and found out the rest of the world was on this WWF thing now, but I held on strong, at least splitting my time, until I saw Rick Steiner having an argument with Chucky. I don't remember anything else from WCW until March of 2001.
And so continues WCW's fantastic build to Halloween Havoc 98.
Yeah, which I believe the catchphrase of the show was, watch the horror unfold. Which probably should have been tagged for Nitro every week at this point.
Shouldn't Jerry Lawler have had the interaction with Chucky?
Why?
It's child's play, isn't it?
Oh, come on!
Oh, no.
Did anyone mention RoboCop, by the way?
No one mentioned RoboCop.
Oh, wow.
I think maybe that pulled in more people than gave credit for at the time.
Well, at that point, no one was watching WCW anyway, so no one knew it happened.
Vito Cruz from TPWW says, I feel like the Nexus was the biggest jumping the shark moment for me in recent history. My interest in general just dropped like a stone by the time that whole debacle of a storyline was finished. They took one of the most unique, hottest angles they've ever done, and then just whiffed on the execution. Most people point to SummerSlam as the point that the angle lost all credibility, but even in spite of that, they still had numerous opportunities to salvage the storyline and botched it on every occasion. There is no reason whatsoever that Wade Barrett versus John Cena in a title versus career match could not have ended up as the main event of WrestleMania 27. That outcome may be obvious as all hell, but who cares? It would have been the logical ending after months of a well-built story where Cena has had to act against his will serving Nexus for months, and if they were dead set on doing Rock Cena the next year, you can quite easily plant those seeds the next night on Raw. But at least in this scenario, you'd have wound up with Barrett as a legitimate, credible headliner. Instead, not a single member of Nexus got anywhere as a result of being in the group, which means it was a fucking waste.
Yeah, the whole angle is one of those frustrating ones which just went nowhere. I'd say for me, in terms of jumping the shark on that, it was after that absolutely fantastic angle, that first one on Raw, which is probably one of my favourite angles ever. It was literally the very, very next show that they did together. I'm going to tune in because I want to see what they do next. What are they going to do next, right? How are they going to top, you know, beating the crap out of everyone and destroying, you know, half the ring in the ringside area? And instead, they come out and they talk about why they did what they did.
Yeah, the show opens with them in the ring doing the promo. Yeah,
and I was like, I was so pissed off when it started because I said, I don't want to know why you're doing it yet. I just want you to keep doing it. Then explain it to me later, because you've just done one act. So when you do a turn around the next week and you explain it, all it turns out is all you had was a bit of a tantrum. Yeah. That's all it is. But if you actually had it as a sequence of events that you're doing, then there's actually some sort of, like, there's some basis there. You have a plan of attack. It was awful. It was the very next show for me that I just completely zoned out and went, nah, they fucked it already.
It's the anti-NWO, isn't it? We've talked in the timeline shows where whether it was brilliance on Bischoff's behalf or just him maintaining, let it grow. What rinse, repeat, getting it over. You know, it would work so well. Similar one to me, I completely agree with that. A similar one for me is the Punk return after a week.
Oh yeah.
Oh god, yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't be as impactful as it is today with social media and stuff, but there's so much stuff you could have done away from the WWE screen.
Yeah.
And then to return and say, oh well, I see you signing a new contract. Well, yeah. So everything you said was bullshit.
Yeah.
With the angle they were going, I thought, oh, okay, is he actually going to say, is he actually going to do what he says and, like, defend the belt in Ring of Honor or New Japan or something like that? Is he actually going to do that? Because obviously he didn't mention TNA, you know, but at least I thought, like, maybe we could do that. I could see him doing it in New Japan and Ring of Honor.
At least the indies or something.
Yeah, something. I thought, like, come on, it's like, it's not even, like, even if it was like a month. Even if it was a month, that would have been something. But as you said, Kieran, the fact it was back after a week or two,
it was just
atrocious. They had an angle that could have been really great where Punk could have had a whale of a time. Just, you know, we talk about social media. Punk would have had a whale of a time on social media posting all these locations he's going to, defending a real world championship.
Go on SportsCenter and plug your upcoming title defense, not in WWE,
even though you're the WWE champion.
Yeah.
Oh, it's narrow mindedness.
Yeah. Oh, we need a minute for some slam. Let's just bring Punk back. Shit.
Okay, so.
It was horrible. When he came back, I remember we all met the next day, actually. A bunch of us and a bunch of our friends, and we were all, like, drinking at a bar. And everybody was, like, down on it. God, why would you do it? Why would you do it now?
And this is a regular occurrence with them, particularly in the last 5 years or so. We just mentioned Nexus. This whole thing was the year later. In terms of summer angles, where they do an initial angle which is hot, and then almost straight away on a key moment where they need to keep towing the line and keep going in the forward direction of the angle, they just completely buckle and go to act two.
Well, to go back to the Nexus, and I think at this point, sort of on the chronology front, the bloom was already off the rose. But look at what happened with Cena. Cena gets fired. And then never misses a TV show.
Yeah. Devante Swing from thewrestlingforum.com says, although I continued watching afterwards, which kind of disqualifies this one, the night after Starrcade 99 was the moment I began losing interest in WCW due to them doing yet another New World Order angle. That concept lasted far longer than it should have, and this incarnation barely lasted a month due to various injuries and a change in bookers. Perfect case of going to the well one time too many. Again, like we said, Vince Russo had absolutely no new ideas for WCW, and this was the thing he was building up to.
It wasn't even just the fact that it was another NWO angle, yeah. The illustrious NWO 2000.
Black and silver.
Yeah.
Black and brown.
Just brown. it wasn't even just that. It's the fact that the catalyst for it is playing off Montreal.
Yeah, the Piper shit.
At Starrcade, you're doing Montreal 2 years later in another company. A company that's already floundering horrifically. I think the email there references that was the point where it jumped the shark for him. If I remember the numbers roughly, Starrcade, they always seem to hold at the MCI Center in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
The year before does just shy of 19,000 for Goldberg Nash.
Yeah.
This one does about 9,000. And I couldn't tell you how many of those are actually paid attendance.
Yeah, and the buy rate, I believe, was like 0.34 or something. Absolutely awful for that awesome show. which was down from the previous pay-per-view. Jack Spago, I think, from the UK fan forum, I didn't give up watching completely. Well, that's another one's disqualified. But the 7th of December made me realise I only really wanted to watch Raw from then on. And even then, I flitted in and out of watching that from 2007 to around when the Nexus turned up. If it was up to me, ECW would have been binned off after that pay-per-view, and you might as well have got rid of the brand split too for all I cared about SmackDown. Yeah, I can't really argue about that. The 7th of December was absolutely god-awful, and everybody knows it. And that, to be honest, at that point, I think it was on its fucking last legs anyway by then. The TV was nothing much to sneeze about.
Oh, it was.
There's only so many Kevin Thorne Balls Mahoney matches one can sit through.
It was already dead. At this point, they're just pissing on the corpse.
Yeah.
The December to fucking forget.
The December to fucking forget. God bless you. Well, I can't say his name because he works there now.
Okay, yeah.
Akira Mitch from FW says, for world class, it was the Fritz von Erich heart attack. I used to love that show, but after Brody's death, leaving the NWA and elevating Rick Rude to the world champ, the exodus of talent to the UWF, Kerry being gone forever with a foot injury, Mike's suicide, and then trying to fake Fritz's heart attack, I just gave up on it. Even the new Freebirds feuding with Michael Hayes couldn't keep my interest.
That is an excellent one.
That's pretty great.
That is a pretty damn good one, because it's, if you forget just sort of world class as a company, the Von Erich family had such tragedy.
It was one jump the shark moment after another.
Yeah, you know, you've got David's death, you've got Mike's death.
Well, Mike's toxic shock.
Mike's toxic shock.
And coming
shock.
Back as the living miracle. And,
yeah, and just sort of. You don't want to say exploited, because it's the father and the son.
No,
yeah.
You can.
But it just...
you absolutely can.
But that's the vibe you get, isn't it? And they were still promoting a show which Mike was going to be on after they already knew he was dead.
Or they'd received
the suicide note, if memory serves me correctly. So, you know, they'd done all this that happened beforehand, to then get to the point where you and I know that Kevin Von Erich has tried to suggest otherwise in shoot interviews, but they're clearly going with the notion of he's having a heart attack at ringside.
Oh yeah,
you know, for the fans there and obviously for the emailer watching, your mind instantly rushes back to all the negative things that have already happened to the family.
Another Von Erich tragedy. And,
yeah,
that's what it is.
From
money.
Man, I mean, we need another death in the family.
Well, that's
fucking terrible.
That was clearly their, yeah. Obviously, that was their thought process, but when a name, be it the family name or the company, just gives this connotation of negativity, and it bleeds into the company that they run, it just, you know, no good can come of it. And I just, you know what their thought process was, but you just wonder why they thought it would even, why they thought it would ever work.
No, and just to draw a parallel though, don't you think there's some kind of humour to me in Fritz faking a heart attack for money? But Vince, when he does it, wants to blow himself up in the limousine. I'll do this angle, but I'm going to do it fucking 20 times better than that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if Shane and Stephanie died, killed themselves or OD'd in the previous years, he wouldn't do it though, would he?
Iron Maiden ROH from FOW says, at the summer of 2006, when they reformed DX and feuded with the McMahons and Spirit Squad crap, I pretty much gave up on everything, including ROH, TNA and everything else for almost a year. I did not really get back into anything until Mania 2007, when a couple of friends wanted to see the Trump McMahon angle, when Batista and Taker had a great match. I forgave the entire past year of WWE. And £10 of gold from the FOW board says, for WWF, I probably started watching in late 94 to 95 and watched everything I could for years and years. Watched every single Raw and most B shows, and it used to piss me off to no end when TSN preempted Raw for fucking curling. However, I stopped watching Raw every single week in 2006, and it was the DX reunion that drove me away. Raw became a complete wank fest of Hunter, Shawn, and the McMahons, as they were all over the place every week until Triple H tore his quad again. That was changed the channel material if there ever was. I'm aware it did huge business, so what do I know, but people who found this crap actually funny and entertaining must really be those stereotypical single-digit IQ hicks when people think of pro wrestling fans.
Was that period incorporating the... Triple Threat with Cena as well?
That would come later. That came during the reunion in 2009.
Oh, sorry, lest we forget.
Yeah, lest we forget.
The final reunion.
Yeah, the one that started when Triple H found Shawn Michaels working in the chef's, working at the restaurant, right, as a chef.
General hideous TV.
Yeah. Coach's ass.
There's nothing. Oh, God. And this and this has all come after Vince McMahon has wrestled God, apparently. There's nothing to me remotely entertaining about watching two men, if they're not in their 40s at that point, pushing towards 40, acting like high school jocks.
Yeah.
Didn't they beat the high school cheerleaders 5-on-2?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. That was particularly nauseating. And even, you know, say we want about the Spirit Squad, but it's young guys.
It's like, this is a stupid gimmick. You're going to try and get this over. Against the odds, they got it over, and then they killed it.
And how were the Spirit Squad officially broken up on TV?
They were
OVW.
First class, Louisville, Kentucky. Slap that on the box. That was fucking awful. Oh, God. It did lead to one of the more bizarre and hideous things I've ever seen, in that Hell in a Cell, when Vince is bleeding a gusher and they put his face in Big Show's ass, and then Big Show's ass is covered in Vince's blood. It's like, if I could ever give a visual to explain 2006 WWE, it's that.
Big Show looking like he's had a curry.
The Thread Killer from Pro Wrestling Only says, I can honestly say that since the Triple H Booker T angle, WWE hasn't gotten one nickel from me that I can recall, and if they ever have, it's never been anywhere near the money I used to spend on them. Now, I'm not one of those thin-skinned, easily offended types, nor am I a knee-jerk liberal who takes offense or sees a double meaning in every nickname or catchphrase. It wasn't just the blatant racism that offended me about the angle, although that was a large part of it. It was the fact that the WWE later actually tried to claim this story was good storytelling, and stating in an article on their website written by some jackass named Brian Solomon that it was good versus evil, during which good would triumph. Anybody who
oh my god,
anybody who knows how the eventual match went knows how good won out in this story. They then tried to claim the story wasn't actually about race for a while. That was classic. The whole ordeal was just so wrong-headed, as opposed to nappy-headed, as Triple H called Booker T, that I just gave up. And Pantsless Yoda 1 from FOW says, it might be a result of living in DC and thus having a disproportionate number of black fans around these parts, but the Booker T Triple H feud in particular gets brought up constantly as the specific moment when people stopped caring.
As a knee-jerk liberal, let me take offence to the No, there are a lot of the suggestions that the emailers have thrown out this evening. There aren't many where, whilst I've disliked them, maybe been irritated by them, there aren't many that I've been genuinely angry about. That one is an example where I was genuinely angry, almost sort of, you know, spitting feathers, livid, watching the show as it happens, you know, ready to throw something at the screen. Because, as the emailers have pointed out, there, it's the racial overtones that are weaved into the storyline and bringing up his, you know, Booker's past with the serving prison time, and you people or people like you worst. Aren't supposed to win world titles.
Looking at the color of his skin as he says it.
Yeah, and it's. And it's all just the way that story's portrayed. There is only one, and whilst I don't like the storyline, there is one appropriate ending to it, and that's Booker winning at Mania. And to get obviously what we ultimately got with the 34 seconds, I think it is, between pedigree and pin, and what, two, three months later, Booker T's losing to Christian in his hometown for the IC title. Not really sure where good overcame evil in that one, Solomon.
It wasn't just the build or the finish, it was everything as well, like the commentary.
Yeah, Lawler was bad during
all
this.
Throughout that match, it was just hitting, and it was just nauseating. And so obviously not for me the jumping the shark of the company, but was it the maybe the jump in the shark for Booker T as a
legit
star? Or
I don't think, even the King Booker thing, I don't think he ever recovered from this.
Maybe not jump in the shark, he was thrown over the shark, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Fed to the sharks.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, but it's
the great white.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh. I'm pretty sure Lawler said that on commentary or something.
Yeah, he probably did.
But it's, because we've talked about the Triple H insufferable title runs ad nauseum, but to me, this was the point in time where it was hammered home to me, really. This was, you know, yes, we'd had the horrible Kane feud, but I never thought Kane was going to win when I was watching that at the time. Even with the build that had happened, Van Damme, I never thought Van Damme was going to win. This one, I thought, yeah, okay, Booker's winning here. The way this story's going, Booker has to win. And when he didn't, that's when I thought, right, okay, we really are set for this pattern now, aren't we? This is the way we're going. Triple H, long title runs, long promos, and it's sort of, it's almost like his early 2000 run on steroids.
Appropriately enough. Moving on to a very big one here, because it seems remiss for us not to mention this during the course of the podcast. Roy from the UK Fan Forum says, the WWF attempting to turn heel, possibly the number one babyface in the world, Steve Austin, at the biggest match in company history up to that point in his own home state. The turn was nonsensical on many levels, but the reason I think WWF jumped the shark at that point is because it lacked credibility and was such an illogical turn that it ruined people's suspension of disbelief. It was scarcely believable that Austin would compromise his values and side with Vince McMahon, but furthermore showed how limited the creative was for Austin once he became a heel. Cagney the Villain from WrestlingForum.com says, Austin shaking McMahon's hand at WrestleMania 17 did it for me. I was a WWF loyalist my whole life up to that point, starting in the late 80s. My love for wrestling started dwindling little by little going into 2001. That moment between Austin and McMahon left a bad taste and was sort of the last straw for me. Gorgeous Dale Newstead from TPWW says, the Austin, who loves you by the way, Carl, the Austin turning heel symbolizes the compromise of integrity in the product often associated with jumping the shark. What made Austin the guy people flocked to was that even though he was kind of a bad guy, was behind all of that he had a code, a la Omar from The Wire, and that code was that he was not a fucking sellout. That was the very foundation of what made the WWF at the time. He was a go-to hero for a lot of people. Yeah, your girlfriend left you, you got fired from your job, you have erectile dysfunctions, but fuck, Stone Cold Steve Austin would die before he sold out to Vince McMahon, but he became just another wishy-washy wrestling character whose allegiances could change on the whimsy of a creative decision. If the company was willing to compromise the integrity of Stone Cold Steve Austin's character, it comes as no surprise that they never really found their stride again after that. From there, the invasion, well, less said the better, and the company slowly but surely stumbled their way into Triple H fucking a corpse on live TV. Somewhere in between all of that, I feel like it doesn't take a fucking rocket scientist to put together that they lost the plot, and it really starts with killing the greatest anti-hero character in all of wrestling history.
I've been listening to another podcast that's been running through all the WrestleManias, and funny enough, the one I've been listening to at the moment for this week is WrestleMania 17, in which they actually have an interview with Dave Meltzer, I'm going to semi-quote, just state that he said that it was the worst booking decision in the history of professional wrestling. That's what actually Dave Meltzer says in the interview. And I'll take that for what it is. It might be him just hyperboling what he's saying in the interview, but I like to take that almost as gospel. Like, even Dave Meltzer kind of agrees with me that it was fucking atrocious.
Oh, no one's going to argue way. The turn was bad. But you're wrong.
Don't make this you and Dave Meltzer versus the world, for fucks.
Nobody likes
it. It is. But it was just interesting hearing him actually saying about like how it wasn't like days later he figured this out. It was as the moment it happened, Dave in his head was just like, well, that was nice. Like, the ride was nice. I might have to look for a job somewhere else now because I'm not going to be doing this malarkey anymore. I might have to look for somewhere else. And it was just because you just knew it was just, like, the worst decision you could absolutely make.
I mean, first of all, on the night, it was everyone in the world. Why would you try and turn Steve Austin heel in Texas? But it is insult that the hug, and it's all they had to do was give Vince the stunner, yeah, I'll work you because you're a fucking moron. And everyone forgets it because Rock's gone anyway, so Rock's not bringing it up, and maybe. But no, it's just a slap in the face of people who, invested something in, who believed in Steve Austin. How did you feel, Carl?
I would just like to say from the start that it shows a wonderful amount of self-awareness from Steve that he's able to acknowledge, as he has done on several occasions, that he made a mistake.
In 2001.
Takes a big man to admit his mistakes, and Steve does. What can you say? It's just, you uttered the sentence yourself. We're going to try and turn Steve Austin heel in Texas. It sounds terrible just to say it out loud.
Write that on the blackboard and tell me you don't want to rub that out immediately afterwards.
That's it. No one in their right mind is going to defend what happened there, and it's that element of logic that I always sort of try and hark back to whenever I'm watching wrestling. Like, you referenced it earlier with the higher power, Liam, and the way it's so illogical, because why does Vince help him beat The Rock? You know, that strand that just sort of gets broken. And when you look at something like this, where you have effectively pissed away 3 years worth, 3 years worth of your programming, the 3 years worth might be a bit of a stretch, but the bulk of those 3 years was about Austin and McMahon. You can trace it from 97 with the stunner in Madison Square Garden and the way it slowly builds throughout all of 98 and most of 99. You've got that element of always Austin on one side, McMahon on the other, by and large. And to just throw it away and to do it in Texas of all places, when, as I think one of the emailers referenced there, they had no great plan going forward. You know, it's bad enough that you've done this. If you've got a smart plan going forward, maybe you can salvage something. I'd argue probably not, but maybe you could. Whereas instead, you have the Austin character betray his sort of morals, his integrity, and then the character almost does a complete 180 and becomes this paranoid schizophrenic.
And not only that, but Pink from the UK fan forum adds, the WF jumped the shark when Triple H hit The Rock with a sledgehammer the night after. Mm-hmm. The execution of Austin's heel turn was great, largely because of Jim Ross's efforts at getting it over. If I remember rightly, the Raw after Mania 17 drew a million more viewers than the previous week had. There was big interest in where they were going with a baddie Austin as champ. The two-man power trip was never the way to proceed when they were so obviously lacking in top babyfaces. If Rock was sticking around, or Shawn Michaels hadn't been on the Gary the previous month, or Goldberg was coming straight in after the WCW buyout, it could have been great. But they needlessly painted themselves into a boring Undertaker and Kane-shaped corner by aligning Triple H and Austin straight away. If Triple H had come down and gone for Austin, then you have a legitimate babyface challenger to him that you can see going through to The Rock's return in time for SummerSlam. I think you extend the boom period by a good few months with a babyface Triple H against heel Austin, which maybe even means you have the NWO and Flair in place to lead the invasion if it begins a few months later. Rob Lloyd, who dropped this on the Facebook page, says, I would hate when guys would team up just a few months after intense feuding. Some instances I can think of are Savage and Steamboat at Survivor's 87, just months after Savage crushed the Dragon's larynx. Another is Earthquake and Jake Roberts were supposed to team at Survivor's 91, just 4 months after Quake squashed Damien. But the one that's the most ludicrous is the two-man power trip. Why on earth would they team up? Triple H masterminded a plot to run over Austin, and just a few months earlier, Stone Cold attempted to murder Triple H by dropping him upside down in his vehicle. Obviously, neither could trust the other, so what's the logic in putting them together?
Absolutely,
so
I mean,
on top of that, they throw this in as well to completely piss away the recent storyline, too.
I mean, that was something that stuck in my craw with the Triple H Austin power trip, was just the fact that they were feuding just months earlier. And we've already stated before, just now in this podcast and in previous ones before, about the whole, the forklift truck incident and so on. It just didn't seem to make sense. And I agree with what's being said about Triple H being a babyface. I'm not going to turn around and try and state that this would have fixed anything, or even that maybe it would have slowed down a rot. But it surely would have been a better option to try and have Triple H be the babyface to Austin's heel. It surely would have been what they needed to do. Without Triple H being the babyface, we're left of Undertaker and Kane, and that was the big issue. I think that was another incident that was just kind of like it drove home the nail, really.
Yeah, 1 month after it happened, I remember Meltzer on the Yada show said, "There's a story in this week's Observer about the numbers for the last month since Austin's heel turn, and the people in the WWE have damn well better read it." Mm. So he knew very like a month out.
Well, yeah, if he's analysed right. Yeah. I think just to your point, and although it's like the lack of logic, the slap in the face with the turn on Vince, the slap in the face with team of Triple H, but it's the whole ambiance and atmosphere of the company that's been built. The fan base exploded over the previous 3 years. The identifying what people identify with the company, it's gone. It's just now a wrestling angle anyway. But the whole what people associate when they think of that company, it's just thrown in their face, and it's kind of left this wishy-washy mess of.
So well, now we've got to boo the guy that we actually don't hate.
No emotional connection to him.
Yes, a Triple H face turn is better than the two-man power trip. Probably. But it's akin to putting a plaster on a gunshot wound, really. You've already done the damage by turning Austin heel. And we've seen there with the numbers for Flair and Hogan with the double turn. People didn't really want to boo Austin. Do they really want to cheer Triple H at that point against Austin, against the backdrop of everything that went before it? It may help the numbers a little bit, possibly. Maybe they don't fall quite as sharply, but it's not a viable way out once you've done what you've done at Mania.
Although it makes more sense logically, and at least you've got someone main event to feud with him, I don't think it makes a fucking bit of difference in the long run. The damage was Austin, not a lack of challenger. Well, obviously, that's there's damage there, but it's.
But Steve acknowledged that, and I think the fact that Steve has accepted the guilt for this, I think, means that we can just draw this to a close now.
And the final one that we're going to mention, I'm going to read some feedback here. Damien Ray from TPWW said, the Sting versus Hogan Starrcade match, particularly the finish, a whole year of Sting not speaking or wrestling, finally gets to the ring for the world title, loses clean. Then Bret Hart comes out for no reason and inexplicably restarts the match, with Sting suddenly finding his wind and beating Hogan. It was such a clusterfuck of a finish and poorly booked match that I officially gave up on WCW. And the real MP from F4W says, Starrcade 97 was when WCW as a whole jumped the shark. And don't tell me about Goldberg, because I don't want to hear it. Okay. And we'll mention that as the last one there, because that seems as a very nice segue for what our show is next week. As we mentioned, it is the fourth quarter of 1997 in the Monday Night War timeline that we're going to get to, and we're going to talk all about Starrcade 97 there. So we'll save our thoughts on Sting Hogan for next week's show. Just as a very quick quick thank you very much, there are so many people who left feedback that we can't get to. Gary NY Simon from the UK Fan Forum, Big Seventh Letter from the UK Fan Forum, and Fake Plastic Trees from Pro Wrestling, and he wrote some great posts talking about, you know, times that they fell out of wrestling, but it wasn't necessarily due to a jump the shark moment, so I've kind of excluded those here, but they did have great takes, so I just wanted to mention them. And Laz from Pro Wrestling Only, Mad Dog from Pro Wrestling Only, Mr. JL from TPWW, and SJ5522 from the UK Fan Forum for their jump the shark moment was actually the death of Chris Benoit and what happened there that obviously turned people off, but again slightly different in the sense that it wasn't an on-screen booked wrestling moment, so I think, I don't want to say it necessarily disqualifies it, but it does take this on a bit of a different course of conversation. So don't want to get too much into that, because there wasn't really too much there to elaborate on in their comments, but obviously completely understandable in terms of that just reviling people and not making them want to watch for a substantial period of time. But with that said, and with all the things that we've talked about here today, very quickly around the room, has there ever been a moment that made you stop watching for a period of time?
Nothing really. I just look at things more like that's stupid rather than getting the emotional attachment of turning me off kind of thing.
Outside of the abyss stuff that you mentioned earlier, turning me off TNA, when it comes to wrestling as a whole, no, I've generally always, I've stuck with it in the TL Hopper and Mantar days. So, you know, if I've stuck with it, then I'm going to stick with it forever, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I always try and stick with wrestling anyway, even if I'm just kind of following it online or whatever. But the only kind of two I can really kind of think of was JBL winning the belt on SmackDown. That put me off SmackDown for years and almost into the now. And Claire Lynch for TNA, because I haven't watched TNA since.
Yeah, I can certainly see. I think there's moments in companies, but in terms of wrestling as a whole, I can't ever say my interest has been killed by a bad wrestling angle. So on that note, I want to thank everybody for listening, and I do want to thank everybody for all the feedback. We had so much to get to. Hope you did an admirable job of tackling so many different jump the shark moments this week, and we will be back in 7 days' time for, as we mentioned, the fourth quarter of 1997 in the Monday Night War timeline. You can go back and listen to our previous timeline episodes at squaredcirclegazette.com for the next 7 days if you like, because we will be back with a show that I'm very, very much looking forward to. Lots of Brian Pillman's death, Montreal, Starrcade 97, Rick Rude, so much to talk about. My God, I can't wait to get to it. So on that note, for G. John Chase,
I have nothing. Bye.
For Carl Jones,
what were you thinking, Steve?
And for Kieran O'Rourke,
I just want to say it was really nice meeting Paige on Monday. I lost your number though, so if you could hit me up at Wrestling Profit, I know you're listening, at Wrestling Profit, and it'll be great to meet you again. Thank you.
I'm Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here. Talk to you next week.